There's been almost 3,000 people shot in Chicago this year already. When we talk about gun violence, the question often goes to, where are the guns coming from? ProPublica Illinois and WBEZ bring us the story of one man.
One day we up there, and we helping people or whatever. That's how I got my nickname, Batman. I never forget that. Romeo, he was like, man, you black as hell. I'm like, man, whatever. He like, for real, you like a Batman suit.
Also, there's a new law aimed at increasing the protection of temp workers.
What we accomplished with HB 690 was an economic justice bill for all workers, regardless of race, gender, and background.
Representative Carol Ammons joins us. Finally, televangelist and Archbishop Fulton Sheen was one of the most famous Catholics of his time. Raised and ordained in Peoria, he was buried in New York, and now his remains have become the focus of an intense legal battle over where his final resting place should be. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you hear the term temp, what image comes to mind? Is it an office worker who's filling in as a receptionist or a day laborer? Regardless of the industry, many who hold the title of temporary worker face problems. So in late September, Governor Rauner signed legislation that's meant to increase protection for temporary employees. The Responsible Job Creation Act received bipartisan support. It will require the temporary workers receive the same wages and benefits as those hired directly by a company. It also calls for increased safety requirements and the tracking of hiring race, gender, and ethnicity. It's being lauded by the Chicago Workers Collaborative, Warehouse Workers for Justice, the AFL CEO, and our guest, State Representative Carol Ammons, a Democrat from Champaign-Urbana. News at WILL in Urbana. Welcome, Representative Ammons. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much, Nyla. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you. We're also joined on the line by Will Evans, a reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. He's with us from the Bay Area. Hey, Will, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Representative Ammons, let's start with you in the new law. When this goes into effect, what improvements will temporary workers experience?
Well, first of all, thank you for raising the voice of this bill and the importance of it. The Responsible Job Creation Act is what we called House Bill 690. And it is really largely an achievement in justice for temporary workers. And I'm going to explain that a little bit further as we go on. But really, 850,000 temporary workers on behalf of a group of them literally get together with us and begin to fight against some of the things that this bill will work on, which is improving safety and training and equipment that temporary workers, certainly in light industrial areas, have to use. But many of them going in don't know the safety hazards that they may be facing in that job site. They also, something that most of us don't think about, but background checks and fingerprints and drug tests and consumer checks, all of these things were being charged to the temporary workers just to work at the job. We eliminated that with this bill so that that was no longer a barrier to employment for them and certainly not a tax for them to be employed under the temporary agencies that they were working for. But there are many other things of this bill, but I want to go back to something you said in the introduction, something we wanted to win, but we did not win. We didn't win the parity in wages, right? It was part of the original bill, but we didn't actually win the parity in wages, which is something that we have to continue to fight and work for to make sure that temporary workers are not perma temps. That's a word that Will knows all too well out there in California, that a lot of industries have turned these really good paying jobs into low wage perma temping jobs where people are working 6 years, 10 years, 15 years as temporary workers, never being offered a permanent position. And this bill works to address that issue.
So that was one of the things that you tried to include in the bill, getting pay parity, it sounds like.
Correct.
And this bill did receive bipartisan support. Is that one of the things you had to give up in order to get the bipartisan support for the bill?
Yeah, in order to negotiate, there were many parts of this bill that we worked on, OSHA requirements and things of that nature. We got portions of that, and then some parts of it we didn't get, like the wage parity, because there's a deeper, longer than your 30-minute show conversation about how to address the economic economic issues that wage parity present. And so we didn't get that into this round of the bill, but we will continue to work with the workers as well as some of the labor organizations to address that in the future.
Right. And then one of the issues here, and Reveal has talked about this a lot. Will, I'm hoping you can jump in on this. But before you do, I wanted to play a little bit from one of Reveal's podcasts. Reveal comes out of the Center for Investigative Reporting. And this is a little sort of example of staffing firms and sometimes the discrimination that happens against temporary workers based on their gender or their racial or ethnic background. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Basically, they refer to people as either a vanilla cupcake or a chocolate cupcake.
They will say, like, no kitties. You know, like, don't send me no kitties, which they refer to homosexual people or women.
That's what's crazy is it's not really a code word. I mean, it's everybody knows what the hell it means, you know. I mean, big hands, small hands. Big hands is man, small hands is woman. You know, blue eyes, you know, brown eyes. You know, that type of thing.
That's from the podcast Reveal. Will, how common is that to have what they're describing there, different staffing agencies using coding to discriminate against workers based on whether it's sexual identity or gender or race or ethnicity?
I found that it was shockingly common that employers, I mean, certainly not all employers, but many employers would look to temp agencies as these to sort of outsource their discrimination as these hubs to discriminate, where they could ask for whatever workers they wanted by race or gender or age. And the temp agencies were under tremendous pressure to please the employers because they were the clients and they were bringing business. And so you had this situation where, you know, employers thought, well, maybe I won't get in trouble if I get someone else to do it. It's easy to ask for it. And the temp agencies, on the other hand, thinking, well, I might as well do this. The client will walk away and go down to the next temp agency that'll do it. So that sort of perpetuates this system where people are being graded on all these illegal screens.
And Will, does this happen across different industries?
Well, I found it a lot of it happening in the low wage industrial temp work. But yeah, I've heard it happens across industries, even in more white collar jobs where people are applying for jobs. I mean, it's you know, it's the same thing that can happen in any industry where someone is screened out. But this is in the temp agency, in the temp industry, it's happening at such a scale that they've developed code words to facilitate it and to communicate it amongst each other without sounding like they're doing something illegal. But like the clip that you played, it's pretty obvious.
Right. Yeah. Those aren't exactly code words that are somehow secret. I think they're pretty clear what they mean. That's Will Evans. He's a reporter with Reveal for the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Representative Ammons, you told in these times that the Responsible Job Creation Act was a deeply personal legislative battle for you. Why was that?
I mean, I think as I when I first started this initiative, having talked to a son of mine who was working for a temporary agency, not in Illinois, I thought the stories he told me were outrageous. And I mean, I couldn't believe that they were operating that way. And I thought, well, maybe that's just in the South. You know, that can't possibly be the case. And when we began to look and we received contact from the Workers Collaborative and other organizations and started to do the research here in Illinois, we realized that, A, the Department of Labor, who is in our state, who's responsible for enforcement, had a difficult time enforcing some of these things because they weren't written in the code. And so we began to look at the Temporary and Day Labor Act so that we can write them in the code. And two, that they had, according to them, staffing issues for enforcement problems. And so we wanted to start working on building a stronger protection for workers, but also addressing the staffing and enforcement side of this from the Department of Labor, who is responsible for enforcing their rights. I do want to say also that the stories that I received from the workers, see, we didn't do a high level kind of, you know, let's research it and write the bill, and then I'll run it all. I'll run the football, right? We worked directly with the workers. Their stories were the driving factors in the kind of advocacy that I believe I brought and my office brought to this issue, because we heard directly from them about having very sick children, but no time off. They couldn't get off of work to go and take care of a sick loved one because they had to move from job to job. There was no protections. They were threatened if they didn't come to work because of a child's illness. Or driving people to a far, far distance away from their inner city homes to a Schomburg or one of the factories in those areas and leaving them there to figure out how to get back home on their own after their shifts. These were things that clearly I'm thinking happening in Mississippi, not in Illinois, right? But they were happening right here in our own community. And because we couldn't see their faces, right? We didn't hear their voices. No one was addressing this issue. And I thought that this was one of those issues that really needed a human face to it. And so we took care of the human face and let them drive us in the work. And I want to say for you also, those who are listening, I believe today it is time for companies, not all companies are participating in this, what I think is an atrocious exploitation of workers. But those who are, it's time for us to really, really redevelop our relationships into democratic institutions so that workers have a say in their productivity and in their time. That is a critical part of democracy, which has been left out of the temporary working industry. It is supposed to be temporary. It
right.
is not supposed to be permanent.
Well, and that's a aside. I feel like that's a whole other issue. How will this law protect people who are in the temp industry now? What kind of changes do you expect?
Well, this law has written inside of this law that companies that they're working for, temporary agencies cannot keep them from taking permanent employment. If that job opens in the same segment where they are working, they have access to that job. They cannot be kept out of that permanent position and transferred to another temporary agency. And so in the law, we wrote that if there is an opportunity for that job to become permanent in that employment, that they have the first access to that job that they are currently doing. So that was important for us. And we will track this. We will track this from year to year to see how many actual permanent jobs are created. And if it's not working the way we want to, we will readdress that issue. So we want to move them from permanent to permanent employees with benefits, which we wrote into the statute this time. Mm-hmm. We also wanted to eliminate the, I think I calculated on a rough napkin, maybe about $220 million that we saved workers by eliminating the charges of consumer charges, background checks, fingerprints. Those kind of things are not going to be charged to workers anymore. So if workers are being charged, they need to contact us and let us know, because once this goes
contact,
into
a, contact the Department of Labor.
Contact the Department of Labor, because okay. We do want those complaints or violations of the law to be recorded. This is something that we also worked on through the process of making sure that people had the protections that the Department of Labor are supposed to offer, and that they are not fired for literally standing up for what they know is the right thing.
Yes, right. Yes. Sure. Will, when this goes into effect, how is Illinois going to stack up against other states when it comes to treatment of temporary workers?
It's definitely out ahead of other states in terms of reforms for the temp industry. These are a lot of these provisions you don't see in most other states, if any states. Illinois is one of the first, I think the only state that's really addressed this issue of discrimination. The bill would require temp agencies to report on the demographics of the people they hire to the Department of Labor. They're already, so you know, temp agencies are already supposed to keep track of this, but what I found was that they don't, or at least some of the big ones don't. And the reason that's important is because if you can prove that a temp agency is only hiring Latino workers are shutting out black workers, as you know, which is one of the most common forms of discrimination, then, I mean, you can hold them accountable. But without any records, it's hard to hold them accountable. This would increase the accountability level. But, you know, I think there's a lot of parts of the bill where it depends on how the temp agencies respond to it and how strong the enforcement is. You know, the part that Representative Ammons was talking about where the temp agencies are supposed to attempt to place temp workers into permanent positions when they open up, you know, will they do that? Will they say they attempted and not really attempt? And then who will hold them accountable? Will it be the Department of Labor? Will it be workers' advocates? Will it be lawsuits brought by, you know, workers? That's sort of where we're going to see whether, you know, this has far-reaching change, or whether it, you know, as one of the worker advocates I talked to said, needs to be strengthened in the future.
Well, we just have about a minute left. I wonder if you could briefly sort of just address something Representative Ammons said about the landscape of work. How much temporary workers really comprise when we look across the U.S. economy? We sort of saw this during the recession. And are we really seeing temp workers really becoming a permanent part of the economy in a way they haven't before?
It's definitely exploded over the last few decades, and it's a growing part of the economy. And it's one of the fastest growing parts of the workforce. I can say that it's still a small portion of the overall workforce. I think 2% is, I've seen that figure. I think it's higher in Illinois and other Midwestern states. You're getting above 3% of the workforce.
Right. But as your reporting has shown, obviously an industry where it's been open to, it seems like, a lot of exploitation. We're going to tweet
everyone out.
Yeah. Thanks for that. That's Will Evans with Reveal. I want to thank State Representative Carol Ammons for joining us as well. She represents 103rd District, Champaign-Urbana. Thanks, both of you, for being with me.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting World on the Horizon, Swahili Arts Across the Indian Ocean, the first U.S. traveling exhibition dedicated to the arts of the Swahili coast and their enduring connections around the world. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
All the time. I think I was like 10 or 11.
I was young.
The way we hustle, we always help with the carts. You know what I mean? Hey, ma'am, can we help you? Hey, we help you to the carts.
Any little dollars or stuff we get, you know, a dollar was worth a lot.
One day we up there and we helping people or whatever. That's how I got my nickname, Batman. I never forget that. Romeo, he was like, man, you black as hell. I'm like, man, whatever. He like, for real, you like a Batman suit.
That's a bit from an audio documentary that was released yesterday by ProPublica Illinois, WBEZ, and the Chicago Sun-Times. Around 3,000 people have already been shot this year in Chicago. And while it's actually not as bad as the year before, it's still much higher than previous years. When we talk about discussions and guns in Chicago, it often goes back to a conversation about how those weapons are obtained, often illegally. The story of how the police go after the people who are selling those illegal guns is the topic of that audio documentary. ProPublica Illinois actually launched this week. This is its very first investigation, and reporter Mick Dumke is here with us in our Chicago studios to talk about his reporting. It was co-published with the Sun-Times and was also part of WBEZ's Every Other Hour gun violence series. Hey, Mick, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Yeah, thanks. Good to see you.
So your reporting showed, let's just start with the big picture, right? That the city of Chicago has seized almost 7,000 illegal firearms so far this year. That goes along with efforts by federal authorities to take down these dealers. How does this work? I think when people think about guns and illegal guns, I mean, I would think, oh, maybe this operates like drugs, which is something you've covered a lot of also.
That's right. Yeah, I seem to be drawn to
all
these uplifting topics. Well, I think the first thing is just to explain to people what we mean by illegal guns. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a type of gun that's illegal per se. I mean, some of those, that may be the case in some instances, but when we say the police recovered or seized 7,000 illegal guns, we're talking about guns that for the most part were bought legally at one point and then were transferred to someone illegally. People hear about straw purchases, for instance. Someone goes who is qualified to buy a gun and obtains it and then transfers it to someone who's not authorized to have a gun. Or they were stolen, loaned out, all sorts of reasons. What I found is from talking to people, a lot of the guns that police recover here are really old. They're several years old in a lot of instances, or even older. So as a police official said to me, they bounce around a lot, and people in Chicago don't get rid of their guns. They seem to hold on to them. So a lot of the guns we're talking about have been around for a while, and that's really important because it's hard to find out where they came from. Not necessarily that original purchase. They've been found to come mostly from out of state, but between the time somebody bought it, say, in Indiana or Arkansas, and the time they show up in Chicago on the street or used in a crime, often it's a mystery what happened in between.
And then there are the sort of these people who are in between, then, who are the people who are kind of using, I don't know if broker is the right word or what you want to use for the people who have this kind of market where they are obtaining or arranging the different sales of these weapons.
Yeah, I think that there's all sorts of middlemen, middle women. One of the experts I talked to, who is a researcher at the University of Chicago Crime Lab, compared this to teenagers getting beer. Every adult is potentially a source for beer. Beer is legal. So unlike cocaine or heroin, guns are also legal in this country. Yes, there are some regulations, some restrictions, but the Supreme Court over and over has reminded us that guns are legal here. So this is a legal product. So it's the market for it is almost infinite in the sense that it's basic economics, Nyla. It's people want guns and people are willing to supply them. So there is a marketplace for it. And we have glimpses of the underground market, but we don't have a great picture because it's underground. I mean, that's the bottom line. But to your point, there are undoubtedly some larger scale traffickers who are moving around some big quantities of weapons. But it appears that by and large, most transactions involve a couple of people, a couple of guns. Usually these are people in the same social networks. Again, making a sale because they need the money or they just want to get rid of something, all sorts of reasons. And
right.
So I think that's why it's
right.
hard to drill down on this.
And that's what you did, though. You did find one story of one person, Batman, we heard, or John Thomas is his. So I guess Batman becomes like his sort of street name, his street persona, right? How did you find this guy?
Well, I met him at federal court through his attorney, Heather Winslow. I was at the Chicago Sun-Times at the time, and with a couple colleagues, we were taking a close look at what the federal government was doing about Chicago's gun violence epidemic, and specifically the kinds of cases they were pursuing. So I came across John's case in court records, and I was intrigued because there were, I think, at least 14 defendants. There may have even been a couple added on later, but there were more than a dozen men who were associated with this case. And John was kind of listed as the top defendant. He was somebody who brokered a bunch of gun sales, as it turned out, 23 different deals.
Right, and that involved like 77 guns?
77 guns total.
Yeah.
And then I met John through his lawyer. I was really curious about the case, and she offered to introduce me to him. And Nyla, I don't know what images you or your audience has about someone who is participating in deals involving 77 guns, but John probably doesn't meet that image.
Why do you say that?
Because he's really charming. He's like a nice guy, and you sit down with him and start chatting with him, and he's very likable. He's easy to talk to. He's not... I didn't ever feel like he was trying to hide something. And I say that I've covered a lot of criminal justice issues, and I know a lot of people who are in the system, I should say almost everybody's in the system, by and large has a reason or an excuse. And I'm not saying John didn't rationalize some of the things he did, but I'm also just saying that An important part of the story to me is the human beings involved and why they make the decisions they make. How can we construct public policy if we don't understand who these individuals are and what motivates them? Right?
That's sad, right? We're talking to Mick Dumke. He's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. We're talking about there's a whole series of reporting that came out this week. It's ProPublica Illinois' first investigation, and it looks at this whole issue of guns, how they're obtained and sold illegally. We're going to tweet out all the links. There's a story. There's a fantastic audio documentary that was released yesterday. I want to just play a little bit more of that as you're talking about John so we can hear a little bit more of his story. In this case, the whole employment side of it.
So I tell him, like, look, this my block. You feel me? Y'all open store over here. I got to have something for free. I just told him straight out. They're like, what's your name? I say, I'm Batman. He what? I say, Batman.
Ali wasn't having it. Not from John. Not from Batman. John started selling weed out in front of the store. Each time he did, Ali, or Ali's son Muhammad, called the cops. One day, they made a deal.
He like, how about I give you a job? I said, you give me a job? Okay, how much you gonna pay me? He like, I'll pay you good masati. You know, that mean money. He was giving me like $65 a day. So I'm young. You know, $65 a day, that's a lot of money.
All right, so that's a little bit, as we were saying, of hearing about John. How much of this is, and this is, you go into this in the, it's 20 minutes, the whole documentary, and we'll tweet that out for everybody to listen, and we're just kind of playing a little bits of it here. Obviously, a lot of this, and we hear this all the time, right? You want to solve the problem of violence in Chicago. People need jobs. How much of this is, how much of that is John's story? He needs a job. He's someone who has, you know, we hear him, he starts off how he's kind of a hustler on the street. He has a couple offenses. So how hard does, where does that factor into also his ability to find legitimate employment?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think, you know, from early on, John got a criminal record. He was, he pleaded guilty to a felony drug charge. I forget what exact age he was, but it was late teens or early 20s. At that time, he was working for one of the neighborhood drug dealers and selling crack on the street. And so he picked up a felony. And, you know, it's, I don't probably have to tell anybody out there, it's very difficult once you pick up a felony to try to go back to mainstream legal work. John did, though. He held a lot of jobs. He worked at grocery stores, worked at restaurants. The clip you played there was when a new convenience store opened in his neighborhood, and he essentially went up and tried to hustle or shake down the owners, and they said, forget it, get out of here.
But then he said, I'll give you a job.
And that's the thing about John. Again, he's really charming, and he is a natural salesman. I always kept thinking throughout this piece, Nyla, that, again, I want to stress that I'm not saying John is innocent. John didn't say he's innocent. He pleaded guilty and to the charges, the gun charges, the case that we're talking about. But, you know, I just kept thinking that if he'd grown up in my neighborhood, even if he'd gotten in trouble, he would have had other chances to kind of right the ship and do something productive. He would have gone into business. He would have been running his own operation.
But he grew up in a neighborhood, part of South Shore, that's called Tarrytown. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's southeast part of South Shore. And
in Chicago.
And I'm not sure where that nickname came from. I actually taught at an alternative high school there a long time ago in the 90s. And my students were calling it that way back then. And so it was an old name, you know, 20 some years ago, it was still an old name. So it's been around for a long time. I don't think that probably a lot of residents find that a particularly flattering name, but that's what John and a lot of other young men who grew up there, that's what they call it, because, again, it's had some issues with gang violence through the years. So I just, you know, I bring this up because to your question about John and the need for money and the need for employment, I think it was always a struggle. We can't blame it all on the neighborhood. John, you know, was raised by an aunt and uncle. And
who were very church-going people.
Yeah. To this day, John is religious. He'll, if you run into him, he'll start quoting the Bible in the middle of talking about a street hustle. I mean, that's just kind of how he is. And, you know, I spoke with one of his siblings who herself is very successful, working on her master's degree. And so you don't want to paint with a broad brush about everybody in the neighborhood or even everyone who's gotten in trouble with the neighborhood. But for John, I think it was always by his own admission. It was a struggle to kind of stay on the straight and narrow and then resist the temptations of these people he enjoyed hanging out with on the street.
So in practical terms, tell me the money differential between what John was doing with legitimate employment and then what he was doing to... He was just like brokering gun sales.
Yeah, so to speed up the story a little bit, he cycled in and out of mainstream jobs, all of which are kind of, let's face it, dead-end opportunities one way or another. When you become a so-called grown-up, I think it's hard to make a full-time living, bagging groceries at the store or whatever. And so, you know, John had this job, had a bunch of jobs. He lost them or they phased out one way or another. So he found himself in a position, Nyla, where he had an infant daughter. He's in his late 20s, he's an infant daughter, and he's got a job at a tobacco store on the South Side where they're paying him just $25 a day. So incredibly, you know, he's making like $125 a week. And so one of the guys who hung around the store that John became friendly with came up to him one day and said, "Hey, I know you're hard up. I got an opportunity for you. I'll help you out if you help me out and help me find some guns." And John says he told him, "Look, where I'm from, we don't sell guns," which is a whole nother kind of question. Guns were in circulation, but it was very quiet, John said, about, you know, somebody might know somebody who had a gun, but it wasn't like people walking around saying, "Hey, I got a gun
for sale."
Hey, you
want to buy a gun?
That
right.
just didn't happen.
Right.
Very quiet about it. So some guy coming up to him saying, "Hey, I want to get my hands on some guns. How can you do it?" I think, you know, John says he was kind of thrown by that at first and had no interest initially.
And then he does do it. He starts making a lot of money. And then the problem, though, is that John doesn't realize he's actually kind of being set up. So I wanted to just play a little bit of that.
John, right? What's going on, John?
We get there, and we end up talking to some nerdy guy with glasses.
And this is in daytime. What happened today?
That nerdy guy is a special agent with the ATF.
This is based on things that have happened over the last 7 months.
He was thinking he's slick.
You know where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
The nerdy guy and another agent are sitting on one side of a table. John is on the other. He acts like he doesn't know why he's been brought in.
Who is this? You're not in here because we just picked you up on the street. Don't act stupid.
On the table between them are several manila folders filled with pictures.
You don't know them?
They're still images, apparently pulled from the videos Yusuf has been secretly recording for the ATF. There are pictures of John's cousin Steve, BD, and John. John looks confused.
You put all this together? Think about what you've been doing since January? I ain't been doing nothing.
Then he suddenly realizes who set him up.
I'm like, Yusuf. Yeah, Yusuf. And I'm like, "Dad, Yusuf just called me 2 days ago."
So that's Yusuf setting him up. Because Yusuf, it turns out, as you find out, is working for the federal government. John ends up now, just to shorten the story, John's now actually, he ends up getting convicted.
Yeah, so the guy we were talking about a minute ago, John met while he was working at the tobacco shop, ended up luring him into this scheme to acquire and then sell guns. And it turned out that that guy, his name is Yusuf, was himself being watched by and eventually squeezed by the federal government. So he decides to cooperate so that he can hopefully get a lighter sentence. And then he essentially works for several months to get John and 13 other guys recorded doing these illegal gun deals. So 14 guys get arrested all at one fell swoop. This is in August 2014. And one by one, they all plead guilty.
Is it clear that this makes a difference, going after these guys one by one?
Well, I think that's the big question, especially in this case, Nyla, where there's no evidence any of them was selling guns before the federal government got involved and started using taxpayer money to do stings. And so the question is, without the government getting involved and kind of setting these deals up, would they have ever happened? John says absolutely not. He never was selling guns until the government started paying him to do so. Doesn't mean he's not guilty. He pleaded guilty. He did the deals. He played a part in it. But, if the gun market didn't exist beforehand and the government creates it and then busts everybody else, does that send a deterrent? That's what they say, but I think it's an open question.
It's an open question. It's part of the work that ProPublica Illinois, which just launched, is going to be doing these deep dive investigative stories like this. Lots more here, lots of work. We'll tweet out all of that so you can see it. Mick, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Archbishop Fulton Sheen was one of the most famous Catholics of the 20th century, especially here in the U.S., where he hosted and preached on TV shows like Life is Worth Living, which reached up to 30 million people every week when it was on the air. The actor Martin Sheen even took a stage name from the Archbishop. Archbishop Sheen spent most of his later years in New York, but he was actually raised and ordained in Peoria. And 15 years ago, church leaders there started the process to make him a saint. But there's one problem. Archbishop Sheen has been buried in New York City since 1979. And when the Bishop of Peoria asked the Archdiocese of New York to have his remains moved, New York said no. All of this has become the subject of a legal battle over where he should be buried. And until that issue is resolved, the canonization process is on hold. Joining me now from New York to understand and explain all of this is Jim Keane. He's senior editor at America Magazine. Also on the line from Washington, Father Tom Reese is a senior analyst for Religion News Service. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having us.
I wonder if one of you can tackle what you can explain to everyone who's listening, what Archbishop Sheen means to many Catholics in the U.S.
Well, I grew up in the 1950s, so I'm old. So I remember.
So you remember watching him, right? Is what you're saying.
I remember watching him with my family. It was extraordinary. He was the first TV evangelist, extremely popular. There were times, you know, this is back when there were only three networks, and he would be at the top of the charts. You know, beating out the other two networks. He had an extraordinary presence. He was funny. He was pastoral. He put a really good face on the church in that era.
And in fact, Father Tom, a lot of the people who were watching were not Catholic, right? When you look at the demographics of what his viewing audience were.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Lots of the people watching weren't Catholic. He was just a very winning personality. People liked him. They warmed up to him very easily. He was a great speaker and a great media personality. And, you know, and I think his goodness just flowed right through the television to the people who were watching.
Jim, you were at this appellate court hearing yesterday in New York City. Attorneys from Peoria flew to New York to argue their case. Before we get to the details of that, can I ask you how a disagreement like this between bishops and Peoria in New York end up in the courts in New York?
Well, I think that that very question was on the mind of some of the judges at the appellate court. They, I think, were a little puzzled how it had gotten there. I think basically what it is it shows the importance for Catholics of the tangibility of the physicality of something like the veneration of a saint or a patron of a diocese or a region, is that the body is important. And knowing where a body is laid, knowing where a tomb is something that has always been central for Catholics in their veneration of saints and in their church structures and the way they practice their faith. And so that it ended up in the courts is probably not the best look for the church, but it is not something that is necessarily that surprising, given what's at stake in terms of people's devotion to Archbishop Sheen and their hopes for what's to come in the future for his canonization.
So before we get to what actually happened in the court yesterday, Jim, maybe you can explain for people who aren't familiar with how people are canonized in the Catholic faith, where the saint is buried is a big deal. And I think the most famous example might be St. Catherine of Siena. Am I correct?
Yes. And actually, if to give an even more common example, is that St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, the mother church of the Catholic Church, in the mid-20th century, archaeologists dug straight down beneath the main altar, trying to corroborate these legends over the centuries that St. Peter was buried underneath the altar. And they found beneath the altar of another church, and beneath that, the altar of another church, going all the way back through the centuries. And then at the very bottom, they found a what's called an ossuary, basically a bone box, with the bones of a man in it. And written on the wall in graffiti in Greek was Petros Eni, Peter is in here. And so the very connection of the church itself with St. Peter's physical remains was clearly important to people from the 3rd century to the 5th century to the 11th to the 16th to the 21st. And you have that connection all over the world with the remains of a saint until really the end of the 1960s with some of the reforms of Vatican II. Every church, every Catholic church had in its altar a relic of a saint. Usually the saint for which the parish was named.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what happened yesterday in court, Jim?
Well, what we have yesterday is an appeal of a 2016 decision by the New York Supreme Court. Fulton Sheen obviously had no survivors himself, as he was a priest and a bishop, but he does have a surviving niece, Joan Cunningham, who had petitioned to have his remains removed from where they are right now, which is in the crypt underneath the high altar of St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, along with many other New York bishops and archbishops and cardinals. And she wanted the remains moved to St. Mary's Cathedral in Peoria, where Sheen was born and ordained. And the court agreed with her, said that she had a substantial argument for moving him. The trustees of the Cathedral of St. Patrick's, on behalf of the Archdiocese of New York, appealed that. And their argument is that the reasons for disinterment are not, to use the phrase, good and substantial. And what the New York Archdiocese is arguing is that Sheen's family, his niece and the Diocese of Peoria, want him moved because that will move forward the cause for canonization, that Sheen's own parents are buried in Peoria, and that Sheen was ordained a priest in Peoria. And what the lawyer for the trustees of St. Patrick's Cathedral is arguing is that Sheen bought a burial plot in New York for himself, suggesting that he did not intend to be buried in Peoria, and that the canonization process is not necessarily dependent on his body being present. Now, what's ironic about this is both sides, both the family of Sheen and the Diocese of Peoria on the one side, and the New York Archdiocese and the trustees of St. Patrick's on the other, both sides agree that Sheen himself did not want to be buried either in Peoria or St. Patrick's Cathedral, but wanted to be buried at Calvary Cemetery in Queens.
Oh, dear. So who's going to who decides this then? Does this get decided by the court system, Jim?
Well, this appeal will come down in 2 to 6 weeks, and the judges did have a lot of questions. They at various points sort of acted as if this was not within their purview. You know, the phrase "not anywhere near my pay grade" was used. But they do have to decide whether or not they often do decide cases that involve disinterring a body, moving a body. And the question is intent. Is what was the intent of the deceased? What's the intent of the deceased's family? And in the case of Sheen, what the family is arguing is that by buying a plot in a cemetery in New York, in Queens, when he knew that the cardinal at the time, Archbishop Terence Cooke, wanted to have him buried in St. Patrick's Cathedral, was Sheen's way of saying anywhere but St. Patrick's, meaning he didn't want to be there. Now, whereas the New York Archdiocese and the trustees of the cathedral are saying this man wanted to be buried in New York, not in Peoria.
So that's Jim Keane. He's a senior editor with America Magazine talking to us about this issue. Father Tom, the Bishop of Peoria, Daniel Jenke, wrote a letter to members of his diocese a few days ago about how the court was going to be addressing this. And one thing he wrote was, quote, "so much prayer is needed." I wonder if you can help us understand why you think devout Catholics in Peoria and church leaders like the bishop are so invested in having the remains of Archbishop Sheen in Illinois.
Well, it's as I listen to this story about this conflict in the court, it reminds me of medieval times when actually villages would go over and steal somebody else's saint and bring it back to their church. I think part of it is that the Catholic community has a great respect for saints, for people who have lived holy lives, who have lived exemplary lives, and they like to have them present, even just physically, in their community, in their churches. These can become sites of pilgrimage, where people from all over the world and or all over the United States come to the shrine where the saint is buried to pray there. So it's important to the local communities. In the medieval times, it was important economically to a town if you were a pilgrimage site. So this is a tradition. At least we're not stealing bodies anymore. We're going to
we're doing through the court system. Well, and I was going to say, in fact, if you drive through El Paso, Illinois, where he was born, they actually have a sign that says "Welcome to El Paso, birthplace of Fulton J. Sheen." So I think that gives you a sense of how much ownership people in Central Illinois want to claim for the Archbishop. Father Tom, can you just walk us through what needs to happen for the church to name a person to become a saint?
Yes, it's a rather long and complicated process.
So maybe briefly then.
I'll make it brief. Yes. It starts with the bishop of the diocese. Now, of course, that's the problem here. Which bishop is going to do this, New York or Peoria? And the Bishop of Peoria really wants to do this. He wants to lead this charge to make Bishop Fulton Sheen a saint. And so the process begins in the diocese where they collect all the documents about his life. They appoint a couple of theologians to look at all his writings to make sure he didn't say anything heretical. They interview witnesses under oath about his life. They're also supposed to ask, well, is there anything negative you know about him that we should be considering? And so all of this information is gathered together, and then it's sent to Rome, where it goes to the Congregation for Causes of Saints. And there it's very thoroughly reviewed, and they produce a biography of him. In fact, they have three volumes, big volumes of papers and biographies and arguments about why this person should be a saint and what virtues he practiced and all that. Then it goes to a committee of theologians, nine theologians, and they have to have a 2/3 vote saying that this person, yes, did live exemplary life and should be beatified or canonized. And then they have to get a miracle. They have to have a miracle that was accomplished, done by God through the intercession of this saint. That is reviewed. Usually these are medical miracles where someone is cured. And they have a whole group of doctors who review these. And basically, the job of the doctors is to say, we have no medical explanation of why this person is now cured. All of that then finally goes to a committee of cardinals and bishops, the Congregation for Causes of the Saints, and they vote on whether he or she should be made beatified as the first step and then canonized as the second step. And all of that, of course, finally goes to the Pope, who has to agree.
Right. And Jim, Pope Francis has actually weighed in on this a little bit, right?
Yes. And, you know, in the case of Archbishop Sheen, there is actually one miracle that the Vatican doctors have stated they cannot find any reasonable cause for. And so it is a very strong possibility for the one of the two miracles that he would need.
That's
the case of an infant in Peoria.
Oh, okay.
Whose mother testified that her infant son had stopped breathing and had no pulse for 61 minutes.
Oh my! Okay.
Then she prayed to she prayed for the intercession of Fulton Sheen. Her baby recovered, had no ill effects, and the doctors can't find a cause for that. So the Vatican has taken that up, and that would be the first of the two miracles that would be needed.
Jim, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, so we just have about just very quickly. I guess what can we expect to happen next?
We'll hear back from the court in 2 to 6 weeks, and that process we could see, depending on who comes out ahead, we could see this dropped. We could see it go to another round of legal disputes. But it seems to me that the Diocese of Peoria is very committed to getting the body of Fulton Sheen back.
So we will see what happens with that. We'll be keeping an eye on this, of course. I want to thank Jim Keene. He's a senior editor with America Magazine. We'll tweet out his story about this. And thank also, of course, Father Tom Reese with Religion News Service. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And actually, that's all the time we have for today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.